take full responsibility for everything this government has been doing in tackling coronavirus, and I'm very proud of our record.
Tens of thousands of our citizens have died avoidably. These were unnecessary deaths because of systematic government misconduct.
With good British common sense, we will continue to defeat this virus and take this country forward.
There were a lot of green shoots of opportunity on the horizon. You know, we've been held down on the forest floor for far too long, and we will reach that canopy again.
Hello, you're listening to Bloomberg Westminster, your daily guide to British politics. I'm Sebastian Salek.
And a very good afternoon, I'm Roger Hearing. Now, Boris Johnson is trying to hold off a rebellion from some Tory-backed benches as MPs prepare to vote on the virus tiers that are coming in, of course, tomorrow at the end of the lockdown. 99% of the country will continue to be under strict restrictions, but some Conservative backbenchers are threatening to go against their own party, saying the new rules are unfair.
Yeah, there's been a lot of speculation around where Labour would land on this. Their leader, Keir Starmer, says he has, quote, serious misgivings about the plans, and he has now said his party won't vote either way.
We're not going to vote these regulations down. It's important in the public interest that our regulations, and it's better that these regulations, which can be amended, are put in place than there's no regulations, which would be the result if we voted against them.
So Labour abstaining, the SNP also abstaining. It means the measures are widely expected to pass. The real measure here, though, Roger, is just how many Tory rebels you get. It's going to be a clear sign of how these votes are going to go. Remember, this has to be renewed again in January, so there are going to be more of these in the future, and it could be very, very tricky for Boris Johnson.
And it clearly is a moment where his authority is likely to be undermined. But what about Labour and all this? Well, joining us now, I'm pleased to say, is John Speller, Labour MP for Warley. John, welcome back to the programme. Good to have you with us. Your party is going to abstain. Will you yourself abstain?
No, I'll be voting against the regulations because I think the government are showing, frankly, that they haven't got a clue and they haven't got a thought out plan. And I'd started off reading their economic impact assessment, and quite frankly, it's very thin, very feeble, and doesn't really deal with the issues of the real threat there is to the British economy and indeed to British society. I fully accept that there is a health emergency, but there is also an economic and a social emergency as well.
So is the rest of the party, or the majority of your party that's expected to abstain, are they wrong to be doing that?
No, look, it's a balanced judgment. And on balance, certainly I feel that the damage that's being done to the economy and to society is considerable and probably unnecessary. If we take hospitality, just been on a weekly call with my local council. I've asked again, have we got any evidence of where the spread is taking place, or what evidence do we have on where the spread is taking place? What about hospitality? We've been doing backward analysis to try and find out where people may have caught the virus. Main area is probably supermarkets. Used to be workplaces, but they're more alert to this now. Hospitality, this is true in national figures as well, is way down the bottom. But the impact on jobs, on livelihoods, on businesses that people have built up and put their life's work and their life savings into is massive, let alone all of their supply chain, which is almost, you know, sort of less visible than when the pub and your street shuts down. But also the impact that has on social life, community life in an area, dealing, you know, with loneliness, sociability. It's a massive cost for a minimal benefit. My concern, that somebody like Matt Hancock is desperate to show he's doing something. This is something visible that he can do, and therefore he's doing that, but without any proper analysis as to how much it will work and whether actually, on balance, it's worth it.
Well, John, one of the issues in all this is clearly it is disputed about the effectiveness or otherwise of what's going on. But isn't the risk that by doing what you're doing, by effectively sending a message to the public that that our leaders, our MPs, don't agree, the politicians don't agree on this, that's simply going to undermine the effectiveness of any measures that are in place?
No, nothing I could say could undermine the public's view and distrust than the actions of Matt Hancock, Michael Gove and Boris Johnson. Their mishandling of it is what's undermining it. Us pointing it out is not going to bring that about. What we're articulating is the views of many, many members of the public. People, you know, the people who are running the pubs and the restaurants who say, we've taken these measures, we've invested the money, we've done what's asked of us, and nobody's taking any notice, and nor are they coming up with anything that says this is how this will work. The debt that we're building up, in many cases, absolutely necessary to keep people above water. But we've got to get the economy moving again. We cannot go on with this massive drop in our national product, which will feed through to how much we can provide in services, let alone the impact that it's actually having on the rest of the health service, you know, with all the cancelled operations, cancelled diagnoses. And frankly, the government have not got a grip of this. Look at these empty Nightingale hospitals. Good idea to build them.
Yeah.
Why aren't they now using them? Instead of trying to panic people that the whole system will collapse, they're not using any of them at the moment.
So that's the government. What about Keir Starmer? Is this a political misstep on his point? It's going to be quite difficult to explain to the public, after all, why Labour is, some would argue, playing politics in the middle of a pandemic.
I don't think they are. I think that's totally unfair. That he's rightly saying, look, the government have not made the case. He's saying that there does need to be some regulation, and that's absolutely right, because, you know, nobody's going along with the extremists who say, well, there isn't really a pandemic. Oh yes, there is, and it's serious, and right the way around the world. So he's got to do that balancing act, and I fully understand and sympathise with that. That's not playing politics. What he's pointing out is there's huge gaps in the government's argument for it. By the way, frankly, if they did get voted down tonight, they would come back with something tomorrow. So, Rees-Mogg would be at the dispatch box at about 7:25 if they lost the vote, saying, Mr. Speaker, I wish to announce a change to tomorrow's business. So we would get back to some sort of regulation and also improve, quite frankly, the compensation to people who are being affected, who are seeing their livelihoods disappearing.
But John, you're voting against them. Don't you think your party should do the same? Wouldn't it be more honest and basically be a better message to the public if Keir Starmer led the Labour Party into the No lobby tonight?
Look, would I prefer that we were taking that course? But I don't like the use of more honest or whatever. That implies somehow bad faith. I don't think there's bad faith here at all. I think that people are taking trying to take a balanced judgment. My argument would be that the economic factors are not being properly incorporated into government judgment. I think that previously, when you've had crises like these, you've had the COBRA mechanism, all departments represented, and also the operational side, very often, like when we did foot and mouth, the military there actually explaining what the immediate practical problems are. Doing it with just about four senior ministers, I think, has been actually shown huge faults in it. And I think it's led to worse decision making. So I think the whole procedure for handling this has been flawed, and therefore people have to make a balanced judgment. I don't ascribe bad faith to people who make a different judgment to one that I do. Equally,
yeah,
I think a responsibility not just to myself but to my constituents and also to the industrial region that I represent also means that I have to take a stand and put across a viewpoint.
Okay, that's the vote today. I've got to get your take on another aspect of the pandemic, which is the slow decline and the impact on the high street. We've got Debenhams closing, we've got Arcadia Group heading into administration. Does the government need to think about bailing out companies like this purely, if nothing else, to save thousands of jobs?
Well, again, I come back to the point, it's actually got to be economic activity that brings this about. The government will not be able to step in. And, of course, there are changes taking place. Before we had COVID, there was a change taking place in the pattern of retail. And one of the things that I think you could argue is that government did not look at an early stage. I don't mean during the pandemic. I mean over the last few years, about the impact, for example, that business rates have been having on many of these companies compared with the way in which many of the online companies have, frankly, they avoid some physical costs, but also they don't seem to be paying so many of their taxes either. So I think the government has been slow to the party in recognizing that there were some inevitable changes, but they were being accelerated by factors over which they did have some control. Obviously, the pandemic has accelerated that, and government. But the most important thing that those companies can and would need is actually customers. Customers being able to get out and about. Doing that in a responsible way.
But bailouts are not the answer. Briefly,
a temporary bailout might be a answer, but it can only be temporary. Because what we've got to look at is how much of the economy will still be here after the pandemic, and how can we power out of the recovery. And when I read, and I'm only halfway through, I must confess, the government's assessment that they finally were forced to put out yesterday, and it's pretty thin in looking at the economic factors. And this isn't about trading, you know, trading lives against money. It isn't that at all. It's actually about sort of what is the proper balance in our society.
Let's have a look at what else is making news in the world of politics. And Roger, we have another update on Brexit in a week where we could get something. Who knows?
Well, let's see. I mean, we've heard this before. How long and how often have you and I, Seb, said this is the week where something actually gets through? But it does look as if it might. EU and the UK both saying a trade deal could be struck this week. The French European Affairs Minister Clément Beaune says he hopes to see an agreement in the next few days. His remarks follow a similarly upbeat tone from British ministers over the weekend. But there are two key disagreements over access to UK fishing waters and the so-called level playing field for business, and both are still unresolved.
Yep, then we have a bit of positive news. The Novavax, which is one of the pharma companies that is doing a coronavirus vaccine, says it has reached full enrollment for its UK study and is going to have some results soon. Bloomberg spoke to the CEO, Stan Erck, who said that this, for them, was an important milestone.
I think a real important announcement was the final enrollment of 15,000-plus people in the UK, 4,400 people in South Africa. I think those are really great executions of clinical trials, and now we wait and collect data to see what the efficacy levels from those two trials are. So it's a really important milestone that we achieved.
That's Stan Erck talking about Novavax, not Novax, which I guess would be what a lot of Novaxers would want, anti-vaxxers. Meanwhile, lockdown is in focus. How much are we actually obeying it? Well, a new study has discovered a quarter of people found it harder to follow the rules during the second lockdown. Findings by King's College London show 1 in 6 people feel there was no point following the guidelines anymore. Bad weather meant you couldn't see people outside. People felt worn down, and that there was unfairness. These were amongst the reasons for breaking the rules.
Yes, it's been a tricky old slog. The weather certainly hasn't helped, but we've got to all power on. Nearly Christmas now, eh? And then it's been a bad day for the British High Street. Debenhams is set to close all of its stores after it failed to rescue itself. That means that 12,000 employees are likely to lose their jobs when the chain's 124 shops cease trading. Comes as Philip Green's Arcadia Group went into administration last night as well. That puts some 13,000 jobs at risk. And it also puts the government under some pressure to help. We spoke to John Speller about this in the first part of the programme. The Business Secretary, Alok Sharma, tweeting, "The government stands ready to support those affected during this difficult period," implying some sort of package could be on the way. It raises questions about just how effective it will be in the long run, though.
Well, the demise of Arcadia, the news also that Debenhams will close its stores, it hasn't found a buyer, crystallised the crisis on the high street. The virus and lockdown, big part of it, of course, but that simply accentuated the problem of online shopping putting bricks and mortar stores out of business. And there's a huge social cost to this, of course, jobs, to the cash economy, to deprived areas in particular. Well, joining us now to talk about this is Scott Corfe, Research Director at the Social Market Foundation. Scott, welcome to the programme. Thanks for being with us. Now, I understand you're halfway through a major research project on all this. Now, tell us what you've come up with so far.
Sure. So the key thrust of our research is we're concerned about some of the political rhetoric around the future of the high street, where it seems that quite a lot of UK politicians think we can we can turn back the clock and revitalize our high streets as we previously knew them, where you had a sort of big retail mix and that was a sort of key bit of the high street. We think that's pretty much impossible. Even before the pandemic, the UK high street was struggling. Many towns and cities across the country had very high retail vacancy rates. And the way we shop has fundamentally changed. If you go back to 2007, less than 5% of what we bought was online. The latest data shows over 25% of what we're buying is online. There's been a fundamental change to the way we're buying goods. We've shifted in favor of the internet. And going back to that traditional twee vision of the high street just isn't possible. And added to the mix at the moment is the shift towards home working. So a lot of city centers, perhaps retail stores, were reliant on commuter footfall as some of the customer base. Well, we're probably in a world where more of us are going to work from home at least some of the time. So again, traditional retail in city centres is going to struggle. So what we're sort of concluding in our research is really we need to think about how we repurpose spaces, because that demand for retail space isn't going to come back. And as well as that, there's going to be decreased demand for offices on the high street. So we think that means devoting more space in our town and city centres to think about housing, so repurposing some of the space, housing for the shops, and then also bringing in things like perhaps sports facilities, more green space, and basically shifting the mix away from retail and offices towards other things.
That sort of is a very broad scope. I suppose, given that with every major shock there also come opportunities, do you see new things that perhaps we haven't seen before attracting us to the high street? I mean, I'm thinking perhaps in terms of mass bike parking, for example, now that many more people are cycling or walking or whatever, rather than taking public transport or cars. Are there these opportunities for new businesses to open up that perhaps couldn't have existed before and could form a new part of what we would see as a core high street?
Yeah, that's right, I think. And particularly if you consider some of our proposals around repurposing space in city and town centres as housing, well, more people living in town and city centres will support other kinds of businesses. So I certainly don't think there is a gloomy outlook for hospitality in the long run, although it's clearly struggling at the moment. But if you have more people living in the centre of town and centre of cities, then that's going to boost demand for hospitality. And similarly, things like galleries and gyms and sports facilities in town and city centres. So I think if we have a big housing mix in our urban areas, then that will support demand for other businesses.
Scott, what about the victims in this, though? Because there are some. I mean, when you see normal high streets emptying out, when people move to either shops way outside the city centre or purely online, there's a lot of people in society who don't have the same kind of access. The cash economy, for example, people perhaps who are unbanked, people who can't really perhaps even get the proper sort of connections online to do online shopping. I mean, these issues have to be confronted, don't they?
Well, I think that's absolutely right, and you are right. There are going to be losers from the kind of change that we see, particularly older people that have perhaps been reliant on going to their high street bank for years. If that high street bank closes, then they are potentially going to lose out on services. So perhaps there is a role there for regulators in ensuring that these more vulnerable consumers are protected and they still can access key services going forward. And of course, the other sort of key loser from this change is the potentially millions of people or at least hundreds of thousands of people that are set to lose their jobs. So the retail sector employs over 3 million people in the UK. It's the biggest private sector employer in the UK. And I think government will have to devote a lot of energy to retraining people to shift into new kinds of employment.
What about the community aspect? I mean, I think it would be hard to deny that the current high streets are very major community assets. It's where people mix. It's where people see each other. If a large chunk of that becomes housing, isn't there a risk that we lose that?
Yeah, and I think that's where you do need some government involvement in repurposing urban areas. Is that you do need to create a sense of community in these areas, and that is perhaps where sort of things like investing in new parks in these areas or libraries or other facilities can help create more of a sense of community.
But I suppose part of the problem in all this, Scott, is you talk about investment at a time when we're pretty sure that when we come out of this crisis, there won't be a lot of money around in the way there has been. We've spent an awful lot just trying to hold on. So is this a situation where the government really isn't the one that should be trying to change things? It should be more communities, perhaps even private companies.
Ultimately, it's got to be a mix. And local government in particular in recent years has been financially very constrained, and local government needs to be financially empowered to drive urban renewal. So one of the things we've recommended in our recent report on the future of high streets is you probably need some write-off of local government debt, so local government is free to invest in communities again, because so many local authorities across the UK are financially constrained at the moment. But we are in a world where government borrowing costs are exceptionally low, and the priority now mustn't be worrying about the size of the deficit or the debt, but ensuring we have a strong economy and ensuring that we don't have any sort of scarring effect where people are unemployed for years to come. So borrowing more now to ensure that government can invest in renewal programs across the UK is well worth it. Like, I wouldn't be too worried about borrowing more in the current circumstances.
And how encouraged are you by what we've heard already from the government? I mean, Rishi Sunak in his spending review the other day was talking about funds that the community has a real say in how they're spent. They've talked a lot about the renewal of large parts of the country more broadly. Is this the sort of thing that is that speaking your language in terms of what you would seek to achieve with what are currently our high streets?
I think there is a question about order of magnitude and whether the kinds of money the government's talking about are sufficient in scale to address the types of problems we're talking about here. As I said, we're talking about potentially hundreds of thousands of people losing their jobs and huge structural changes in the nature of town and city centres away from retail and offices. So the regeneration challenge is huge, and the government has to put a lot of money towards solving this issue. So I think the rhetoric is right in terms of what he's talking about. I think the order of magnitude of funds available is probably not sufficient.
Bloomberg Westminster. Listen weekdays at noon on DAB Digital Radio in London.